Hi, it's Sam Downey here, and welcome to Sam Downey's Techcasts, in association with DailyTechTalk.com. This podcast was recorded live at the Sounds Expo 2007, which took place at Olympia 2 in London. For more information on Sounds Expo, go online at www.sounds-expo.co.uk. This podcast was recorded live at the Producers Seminar, which was hosted by Sound on Sound magazine, and it features music producers Mike Howlett, Marshall Jefferson, and Steve Levine. Here's the seminar, live at Sounds Expo 2007.
Welcome. Today I'm Martin Walker. Some of you probably recognise my name from Sound on Sound, but they've unchained me from my PCs and let me loose in the wonderful world of music. We're very lucky today to have three world-famous producers. I don't stand a cutting house chance of remembering what all of them have done, so I've made a few notes. On your left is Mike Howlett, one of the original Pothead Pixies, who played bass and silbos with the band Gong back in the 70s, and began producing in 1977, working with artists such as Berlin, China Crisis, Joan Armour Trading, Martha and the Muffins, Orchestral Manoeuvres and the Dark. He won a Grammy Award for his work with Flock of Seagulls, was a founding member of the Music Producers Guild in 1987, is now their chairman, and in 1992 he organised the first ever rock concert in Moscow's Red Square. It's a good start. Sitting next to him is Marshall Jefferson, producer and DJ, who made the first house music record back in 1986, introduced the world to house piano, and also produced the first acid house track, complete with squelchy bits from Roland's TB-303. He's worked with CC Rogers, Future, Ten City, Kim Mazzell, The Pet Shop Boys, Frankie Knuckles, done many remixes for clients as diverse as Tom Jones, System 7, and Ryushi Sakamoto, and is also a prolific songwriter. Sitting next to me is Steve Levine, who produced all of Culture Club's classic hits. The Honeys Platinum Album 1 to number 8, and has also worked with the Beach Boys, China Crisis, Gary Moore, Ziggy Marley, Louise, The Creatures, Lemmy and Motorhead, among many others. He's also won a number of awards, including BPI Producer of the Year, Music Week Top Singles Producer, and a Grammy for his work with Denise Williams. He's also the director of the MCPS, and of the British Academy of Composers and Songwriters. Ladies and gentlemen, the Sound on Sound Producers panel. I thought I'd start the ball rolling with a question of my own, to put everyone in the right frame of mind. Producers can do a whole lot of different things. At the most fundamental level, I'm sure the most important thing is to make the clients feel relaxed and give them a nice cosy environment so that they can give it their best. But many producers also may act as stylists, bring their own particular treatments and sounds to mixes. Some artists will come to them because they want that particular sound. Others may end up playing on sessions and collaborate, even co-write with some of the artists. And in some cases, they may even take them in totally different directions, this sort of guru approach. I think Brian Eno is one producer who's particularly renowned for this. So my question to each of you in turn, really, as a producer, are you a friend, a counsellor, a guide, collaborator, guru, or nothing like that at all, something completely different? What is the most important thing in your role?
Well, I think it's friendship, and I speak from personal experience, friendship should be out of the question if you want to get a successful production, because friends fight, man. You know, you want to be objective and you want them to respect you and listen to you. And I think you should leave friendship at, you know, out the door. Really. I mean, you could be friendly with them, but I made the mistake of being friends with all of my acts. So,
it is a business, so I think if you have a, like the same as film directors and actors, this one could be, if you can get the best out of an artist because they trust you and you have a good relationship, I think that's really good. But I think you're right, I think you shouldn't really ever cross the line and And the worst is if ever you have a personal relationship with one, something that's really a no-no area. Because then lots of problems happen. In fact, I also find that a problem sometimes within bands if there's an internal relationship that is more than friendship. I think it can cause problems because I think people's judgment can be impaired. Something that's quite important.
Well, that's the natural progression with all bands. All bands wind up breaking up and hating each other. All of them. Without exception. So there's your proof right there. All bands start out as a group of friends and they're having fun together. You know, things happen when projects get famous and successful. You know, people just have to go different ways sometimes.
How about you, Mike?
Well, my view is that, you know, what the producer's role really is an interpreter. He's an interface between whatever the artist's idea is and realizing it in the studio, which is, to me, like the quintessential part of that role. And so it's down to what it takes. And sometimes it does take you to be, you know, friendly and understand, you know, the fragility of an artist. Sometimes it's exactly the opposite. And I think that's what we're seeing there, that sometimes you've got to be rough and brutal with the poor delicate things, and sometimes you've got to, you know, nurse them through. But it's really that. It's down to, you know, every single recording is a different situation, is a different context. There's no clear, simple plan, and some of it's down to your personality. You know, I tend to be a fairly easygoing guy, but it's, you know, it's true that not a weird thing that when I look back, the songs that were the biggest hits I ever produced. And every one of those sessions, when I analysed them, was stressful. You know, it was not easy. There was always a complication. And I did get to the point where when the session was going really too well and too easy, and it was almost too much fun, and I thought, you know, this isn't going to happen. There's something wrong here. You know, I mean, I wouldn't go out of my way to make trouble. But
I think as the industry has gone almost full circle now, I think that situation has changed a little bit. Certainly, as you and I would remember it, in maybe the late 70s and early 80s, where it would be the record company that would phone you because they've just signed band X, Y, or Z, and you'd have no prior relationship with the band, and you would be brought in because of what they've just heard you had happened to produce, or you had a relationship with the A&R man. What's happening now, or certainly what I'm finding, is the bands are approaching me direct. So you're working with them at a much earlier stage in their career. So consequently, there's a much better working relationship. It's far more professional on a business level, and it's a lot more professional on a creative level, and you're sort of almost cutting out the middleman, so you have a relationship. I wouldn't choose to work with that act if I didn't like them or get on with them. As I said, it's, you know, never crossing that line, but I think you need to get on with people and have a similar view about culture, a similar view about the kind of music that you'll enjoy and love. I think if you have that, you can work really well. Whereas often, I'm sure it's the same for you, Mike, but certainly when, say, Virgin, for example, because we both did a lot of work for Virgin, and in fact, we both got with China Crisis, interestingly enough. And I remember them in particular, you know, they had a very strange relationship early on with that guy up in Liverpool that did some of their very early stuff. And they found it really difficult work, or certainly in my case, they found it very difficult breaking away from that situation. And in many ways, probably the best work that they did was when they were first starting it almost at home doing their demos. They found it very unnatural working in a big studio. I don't know if you found that with them. I found their relationship very difficult to work with because they were taken from something they knew and loved really well, and they almost resented Virgin a lot of times. Did you find that or not?
They were definitely one of those, you know, fragile bands.
Yeah, we
did it at the Manor, which is for, you know, like, you know, super deluxe,
yeah,
you know, country manor house studio, and, you know, all the trimmings, and they got a little bit carried away. I know they were, you know, they sort of exceeded themselves in a strange way. But I think I caught them at a good point because they'd done an album with Pete Smith.
I can't remember who it was now. Pete Walsh,
or Greg Walsh, one of the two. Anyway, they had a hit, and so, you know, I was coming in to get them another one, and I think by then they were a little less.
Hmm.
When did you work with them?
Immediately after African White. Like, so and that was the, which I can't, I mean, it was, they were very, I mean, all I was using that as an example was where That's a band that in today's climate would probably have been even more successful, because I think that the way that we make records now and the way that we market records is much more aligned to the way they work. Whereas there were some corporate acts that were just in, and you'd go into the studio, you'd have almost no relationship with them, but you'd make a great record, you come by and you'd never take a phone call from them again. I am quite thankful that the majority of artists I've worked with, without exception, and including Chiang Kress, actually, because I saw them very recently, I've remained reasonably friendly with. I mean, you know, which I think is quite important.
Yep. Shall we open this up to the audience and see if anyone's got any riveting questions out of this? There's a hand over there. Something
like that. We have a roving.
That's a roving shout. Mic.
Oh, there's
it's
a roving,
roving at the moment.
You want me to shout?
Oh, we can hear you, yeah. Go on.
There
he
comes.
Hugh, is this one all right now?
Hi. Hello. What would your advice be to an artist starting out in the business world as you see it today in the music industry? And how do you think an artist could progress his work within the industry in terms of internet lines or any other ways?
What kind of music?
It depends on the music.
Absolutely.
Really.
It depends what type of music you're making. If you're making R&B, then there's one way of working. If you're an indie band, that's a completely different way. An indie band is going to really help if you're playing live and have a small following and you build up your MySpace. With R&B, it's a studio-based thing, and you need to make sure you've got, you know, a radio station that's grooving what you're doing, because there may not necessarily be a live thing in the short term. So it's quite a difficult question to answer. But I think you need to align yourself with a engineer, producer, or someone. If you can't do that yourself, you need to align yourself with someone that can help you realise what you want to do, and then come to an arrangement with them financially that you're comfortable with.
I know Marshall has got involved with a lot of different genres and spearheaded various things, and then not really wanted to be thought of as the originator of a particular style. You prefer just to work with that musician. So every person you meet has a slightly different style and a different way of doing things that will do best for them.
Yeah, well, things are kind of different, like from a dance music perspective. A lot of times you can just get a record played somewhere and somebody will buy it. And that's one of the flaws of dance music, because right now it's like 30,000 dance music records a week coming out. That's definitely a problem getting there. As far as indie bands, rock bands, like you said, it's good to get a following and playing out. I know a few bands I've seen, and I've stared toward a couple of majors just for the hell of it, you know, and they got deals. But it's just as far as indie bands, you just find your venue, you sharpen up your band, and see where it goes from there. I'm not necessarily with the idea of finding somebody to finance you and push you. I think you should concentrate on perfecting your sound, and because the home studio recording stuff is really coming, you know, it's really caught up to the big studios. And the only thing you're missing is your acoustics of the big studio. But home studio, I mean, you're 32-bit, and in a lot of cases, 20-bit or 20-bits is good enough, but because all the CDs are going to 16-bit, so you got good quality recorded at home. I'm doing records at home on laptops and stuff right now, so I think you should concentrate on getting your home recording together and getting your quality as good as it could possibly be. That's what you concentrate on. Your band sound, the sound quality, and everything should take care of itself after that. If you're playing out and you're getting a following, if you're talented enough, you'll get noticed.
Another question from the audience. Yep, let's hand up there.
I'm hearing a lot of recordings that are coming to you possibly before you're asked to produce something. When you get these recordings that are done at home by small bands, what are the sort of things that make you cringe the most when you hear them. Avoid this at all costs if you're going to send in something.
Well, the majority of things are always the bleeding obvious. I mean, I get a ton of CDs where there's nothing written on the disc, and a bit of paper that's got the song titles. Well, in my studio, it's neat and tidy, I can assure you, but it's going to get separated. Or, you know, you can't make out the phone number or whatever. So even if I love that track, there's no way of me getting in contact with the artist. I think, again, it's very genre-specific. If you are a singer-songwriter, then I personally believe the song presented to the producer should be as simple as possible so the song comes through. If you're a specific band, then I think you need to at least give some indication of where you might be going, what particular style you might be wanting. And if you have a guitarist who's developed his own specific technique, that should be made very clear on the CD. And bearing in mind that most people haven't got endless hours, so there's no point in putting 30 songs on there and with all of them with 15-minute guitar solos at the front, because none of us have got any time to listen to that. Be very short and swift. And in some cases, if you've got, 20 great songs, really listen to them, find five of those, and maybe put, 10 seconds or 20 seconds of each one on the CD. These are the highlights. Because if someone is genuinely interested in your material and you're pitching to someone wanting to take it to the next stage, and that can be a producer, record company, publishing house, if you want to take it to the next stage, if you whet their appetite and they go, oh, that's pretty good, then that's the way forward. But still, time and time again, presentation is really, really important.
I have a song right now that somebody gave to me at a party on CD, a blank CD. I played it on 7 radio shows, and every time the switchboard is lit up, people calling in about the song. I don't know the artist. It was a blank CD, no title, nothing. And I know he's out there somewhere. He's out there somewhere. No title, no nothing. Who's that? What's that? What's that? Everywhere I play it, because I play out a lot. It's just frustrating. There's a deal waiting out there for him. Yeah. Just contact.
There's also a great quote that I read from Billy Sherrill, produced a lot of country and western stuff in America, and I think he did Stand By Your Man, amongst other things, and Ray Charles was a strange man. But it's just a great quote. He said, always go in the studio with a hit. And then once I read that, I thought, this is the most blindingly obvious thing, but it really doesn't matter in a way, unless as Marsh was saying, there's absolutely, you've got this great song and you can't even get hold of the bastard. But all you're really looking for is a hit song. When you hear that song and you go, that's it, I know I can make that into a hit. And every song I produced that was a hit. Well, we knew when I went in that studio, I wasn't going, maybe I could turn this into something, that's a hit. My job is to get it right, get the arrangement right, get the production right. So, I think the packaging is really important, especially for record companies, because they do look, I've had a lot of A&R guys who said the same thing, that they hear a song, they think the song could be a hit, but then they want to see that the band is going to get out there, or the artist is going to get out there and deliver it. And that's the other half of it, because it's not just about the great song, it's about an artist who's prepared to go and front it, and be standing there's a Muff Winwood, retired now and was the head of Sony, but a member of the Producers Guild for a long time, and he told us once, and he said, I never feel bad if I pass on an artist, because I know that if they've got the will, they'll be back, They really believe in themselves and they've got the drive to do it. But the worst thing is to think I can, this artist is a great song, but that artist hasn't got the will to get out there and make a star of themselves. And that's what they're also looking for. Less so, I'm the producer, we just think we can make a great record, but I know that's what the A&R people are thinking all the time. They're thinking, how can I, is this, if I put this energy in, is this artist going to back it up with their own drive, their will to succeed, their belief in themselves, and that's as important.
And I think it's becoming more important where an artist's revenue now, particularly if you're a performing artist, you can add quite a large, significant proportion to your career playing live, because whilst everyone is downloading and pirating or whatever, if you don't buy a ticket, you can't come into the gig. And so a lot of artists know that They've got their captive audience. They're also, in most cases, preaching to the converted. So the people who come to see them are there because they really like them. And they're also happy to buy their CD at £10 or whatever, the, you know, five tracks for £5. So that's really important. And I think, to pick up what Mike said, is that there is now such a high level of home production on some tracks. You also need the live endorsement. That person is actually able to do what is on that record, because it actually, yes, there are some great studio records and we never expect them to be live. You know, we know from certain productions that you can never perform that live, but generally there's a big swathe of stuff that should be performed live. And if the record has got, you know, too much auto-tuning on it and a guy can't or woman can't sing or whatever, they need to know that, because there's no point. If you can't cut it live, you don't really have a career. And that, again, it's genre specific. I mean, you know, again, as much as in certain dance areas, that doesn't apply, because it's a different area.
Well, it applies in all areas, really. You need the artists. People are not going to... That's why there's a totally different kind of music in the States and Europe, you know, because the States are not going to promote most dance artists, because most United States record companies, they look at a dance artist, you know, like a DJ, and then, what does he do? You know, they want Madonna, they want the next Madonna, they want the next Justin Timberlake, and when they see a DJ up there standing behind some decks, they say, how do we promote this? Get them out of here. You know, they want the artists. So,
I think the most encouraging thing to come out of this is that these guys obviously do listen to all the stuff that's sent them, which is extremely encouraging. Another question from the floor. Guy at the front here. He comes to mind.
Hi, guys. Just to go back to something Marsha said earlier, he said he was doing home demos on a laptop. I'd just be interested to know, and from Mike and Steve as well, if they do this and what software they use.
Well, I'm Logic.
I'm Logic, and I'm Logic Laptop and Liquid Mix, and I do records on that setup.
Yep, Logic and three Pro Tools, actually. I like Pro Tools for the audio editing, but Logic, I usually put stuff down.
Thanks.
But then there's the mic pre's.
Oh, yeah. Open that can of worms.
The AD conversion now. Where do you want to get it? No, the truth is that you can do that. You can do it, obviously. We know this technically. What hasn't changed, which I think... is to be brought into this equation, is input, a quality signal in, and that's good microphone technique. That's, you know, to me, that's where people kind of...
None of which we're exhibiting how many these, by the way.
That technology hasn't changed, yeah, has it? Yeah. How many, 50, 60 years, you know?
Your mic is one of the most valuable investments you can make, and the great thing about microphones, I've still got mics that I bought in the 80s when I could afford to buy those kind of mics, and they're still as valuable today as they were there. It's one of the few pieces of equipment that actually doesn't lose value, particularly if you keep it in its box and look after it and don't leave it lying around and full of smoke and all that kind of stuff. But you know, if you've got money to spare on any particular piece of gear, your mic will really, really pay dividends. Marshall?
Well, it's the quality right now is outstanding. The demos I hear, this is not really a problem with quality. You talk about what makes me cringe. It's not the quality. Usually when somebody lets me hear a song, it's really good quality. I mean, people are getting their home setups and they're really doing magic with it. And I used to think that big studio experience helped a lot. Well, it helped me a lot, because I knew how certain pieces were supposed to sound and you know, how the overall mix is supposed to sound from working on an EVE or an SSL. But I don't know, the guys start from scratch and sounded really good, so.
Still going to be a good performance in there.
Yeah, performance is king.
It'd be the best microphones in the world, but you know, the guy is not delivering from the heart.
He's got a question.
Yeah.
Okay, next question.
What I was going to ask was, what kind of techniques do you guys use to coax the best out of a musician? And how do you know when you've got there? Or how do you know when you're never going to get there?
Well, I never let a vocalist sing for over 3 hours, because I want peak performance that entire 3 hours. Now, I used to do it longer than vocals, the voice would be in shreds, you know. But I feel that they look not so much as lose their vocals, they lose their concentration after a few hours, a certain amount of hours. I want the peak, the best they can sing, the, you know, with the most emotion for that 3 hours. And that's just personal. Of course, it helps to have another thing with vocals. You absolutely have to ride the vocal level, you know, and even it out to get the, you know, to get capture that emotion. You know, when they going into dynamics, singing softly and then banging it out. So riding the vocal level within your mix is also extremely important.
How do you coax that perfect performance from them? How do you get them in the front right frame of mind to give their best?
I think it's trust, because if you say it's shit, they need to know it's shit. But if you also say it's really great, they don't know what to
know. Well, it's different with English vocalists and American vocalists, European vocalists and American vocalists. Like, American vocalists seem to have more confidence. You know, like, I can get an English vocalist in the studio, they'll sing perfectly, you know, everything, boom, 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 great. They'll say, oh, it was horrible, it was horrible. You know, they sing it. I get an American in there, and he'll screw up for the whole session, right? And at the end of the session, ain't that the greatest thing you ever heard?
It's the American way.
Can I say that there is a technique that I evolved about this, which it came about just by observation, was the two things. One was that, you know, I used to do a lot of very patient math, so I do a lot of compositing and vocals. So, you know, I get a singer to go out and sing, you know, half a dozen takes, and I keep maybe a dozen, and I keep the best sort of four or five, and then I spend hours, you know, and I sit through the whole thing. And it used to really piss me off that, you know, I then play it back, and the singer would go, that's good, but I can see it better now. You know, and I realized that actually they could, and I'd give them a chance, and they would sing it better. And I realized what's going on here is that it's like when you have to go and sing a Beatles song, a song that, you know, is a huge hit that you just know. I mean, I'll bet, you know, 90% of the room could, you know, even the worst singers will scrape through it and do a version. And it's something to do with having it in their, you know, it's being defined. They know what they're going for. But when you're doing a new song that doesn't exist, you know, you're the producer, you're making this new thing, and even if it's being demoed, you know, the definitive version is what you're after. You're after that take that's got it all, and that's, you know, and got the emotion, and that's got all the melody. And by doing this, going through all this very time-consuming process, you've allowed the singer to somehow clarify in their mind what they really want to do, and then they'll go and do it in one take.
That's another important thing, the demo version. Like, I have very famous guy vocal versions that are never going to be heard ever, but, you know, they laugh at them, but you let the singer hear that. If you're writing the song, or whoever writes the song, you let the singer hear it, practice it for a month, they'll come in and they'll knock it out. Really, you know, once they know the song, they're familiar with it, it's so much easier on the session than them trying to learn it during the session. So that saves a lot of time.
I think I totally agree with Mike as well, that you sometimes, through the comp, you define how the shape of the song will be. And it is very true that sometimes a singer can then go away overnight and come back the next day and has now sort of can see the blueprint of how the song will work. And I find that particularly true of R&B, where there's a lot of ad libs, you know, at the ends of choruses and things, and it takes the singer quite a while to feel confident in their own voice as to what shape works over the rhythm track. And it might be that you have to get a comp, and sometimes even with ad libs, you'll comp something together where there's a half that kind of works with another half. It doesn't work musically, but it's showing a journey, and they can just listen back to that and then re-sing it, and it'll sound fantastic, and they have more confidence.
So how do you cope with the artist who wants to create in the studio from scratch? They're not quite sure where they're going to go. You're not quite sure where they're going. How do you guide them forward?
That's a big project to take on. I mean, it depends on how you're presented. The song still is important. I mean, I couldn't possibly start a session when somebody says, I've got this idea for a track and it might go like this and it might go like that, because I think you're all going to waste an awful lot of time. But I'm quite happy for it. In fact, I have a track at the moment that I'm working somewhere. His own demo, because he was very inexperienced, was really, really quite appalling. So I said, well, just playing the song on the acoustic guitar. And I could hear from the the two things that really struck me, the lyric is fantastic. There's a couple of lines in this song that I've never heard those rhymes and those words before in another song, so immediately I'm drawn to that. There's a couple of parts of the melody that are really, really strong, and I think he's really good, but the structure of the song does need a tremendous amount of work. So with something like that, I'd be prepared to take that on, because I do think that in there is a fantastic song. There's enough bits in that song that I feel I could probably work with him and get it to be very, very good. But you have to be very confident, and you also have to have an artist that's willing to give and take. You're not saying, well, this is how it's going, and I'm not, you know, not budgeting.
How about Marshall then, when you're working with all these different dance genres and sometimes spearheading new ones? How do you know when you're there, or you're dealing with, it's ephemeral, it's like smoke and mirrors, isn't it?
Well, that's before I get in the studio, you know, that's a demo stage. When if I don't hear it in a demo, then there's no session, as simple as that. So pretty much we know what we're going to do before we get in there, and we just do it. Everything's all sequenced and planned out, and the vocalist been practiced and listened to it. You know, we just go in and do it most of the time.
Okay, another question from the floor. Guy down here at the front.
Yeah, hi. My name's Clyde. I'm just call my friend from Bristol. And, you know, the Southwest, especially the Bristol scene about 10 years ago, was very experimental back then. There was a lot of you know, kind of competition, but people willing to go to the edge to create that new sound. As producers, and especially with corporate record labels, there's always a formulaic method into songwriting. Are they starting to break down barriers now? Are you starting to see, as producers, new sounds coming out? Because
absolutely. I think it's gone completely the other way now. I mean, I haven't worked for a major record company for, I don't know, a long, long time. It's much better for you to go to the major record company with your band, where they're... It's an interesting thing. We've become, or certainly in my case, and I know this is true of other producers, we've become the sort of R&D A&R department, where we have to research and develop the act. And that applies probably more towards an artist, a band's shape artist, and that could be two people to four people, rather than in my area, because I don't really do dance stuff, so we'll see. He'll know differently, but certainly in my area, they are expecting you to come to them with quite a lot of the R&D done. Then they can view it differently. Gone are the days when I first started, where I would be given demo time by a major record company to go in and see what happens, and if nothing happened, fine, everyone walks away from it. They don't have the budgets or the time or the inclination, so it's our responsibility now to work directly with the artist, get it to that next level. But by doing that, you're much more likely to find a maverick sound or a maverick way of doing things, because when you present a finished product to somebody that has this weird thing on it, whatever that is, they go, wow, that's fantastic. Whereas if you're describing what that is, it's really hard to get that across. I mean, it is true that the A&R men of old will have said, well, you know, so-and-so's in the charts, you know, the Kaiser Chiefs in the charts, so give me five more Kaiser Chiefs. Those days are gone now.
Yeah, absolutely. He's right. All you need is a finished product, and if it's well produced and finished, you can do any style you want. I mean, it's got to be finished in quality, and they'll hear. Majors are very open now.
And they pay a premium price now, interestingly enough. So where you might have gone, give me a small demo budget or whatever, and then... If something is proven, you've got your band, you've got your MySpace, you've got your fan base, you've got the producer on board, the team or whatever, you've taken away several thousand pounds worth of development from them, so they're actually prepared to come in at a slightly better level. And the bands are more open, and you can then say, okay, I've paid for these masters, these are my masters, I will license these masters to you for 5 years, and you can come to a much more professional deal. In fact, that's something that the dance market took the lead on, in licensing rather than direct signing.
Yeah,
it's such a difference.
I would say that, I think that's the sea change that we've all seen over the last 10, 15 years. Sony started it when they had licensed repertoire in the early 90s. And what you find with all the major labels now, what they do is they sign labels. They don't really... Very few, I mean, maybe James Blunt, I suppose, the last actual artist. But it's a very...
Even that came through a publishing route, didn't
it? Right.
Yeah. The publisher had acted as a quasi-record label and developed and put the R&D in. Yeah.
And it's kind of like my little thing, boring repeated line of the current period, but about the whole download shift, the way the industry is changing. But when you take out of the equation the fact that, you know, it used to be studios... you needed that big funding to have a big studio to make a good quality record, and that's taken out of the equation now. Then you needed, still needed fleets of trucks to truck, vast quantities of plastic around the world, and they were very ecologically friendly, but also very, machine intensive, but that's taken out of the equation with the, direct online distribution. So that leaves what is a record company in the end, and really, a major record company's best function is global marketing. That's what they're for. That's what they're good at. And then the A&R side is down to, it's kind of open, It's not a terrible scenario for me. I think it's a hugely positive time we live in, where anybody who's got a really good idea can take it to that level.
Absolutely.
Then you need, you need to, there's a million MySpace pages out there. You need marketing, you need promotion, you need that machinery and the people who are good at that. Creators are, we're not, it's not what we do. We make the good shit, and then we hope that they know how to sell it. But that's to me where we are in the industry.
I mean, the reason that we're called record producers, it goes right back to the beginning of recorded history. And you think of somebody like Sam Phillips, who is a very good example. He had his own studio, and in fact had his own lathe, and the artist would either rent his studio at $25 a day, or if he took a fancy to one of the artists, he would sign them to his own production situation and license it to RCA, and that's how he had Elvis Presley. So I think we've gone full circle. We are now taking on that role. We're acting as mentors, producers, kind of managers, and developing everything. But at least if we all own the rights to the recorded work that we license on, I think that's a great. And then we can. The great thing that record companies do is that, as Mike said, they are great at global marketing. But even on a small level, you can put your stuff on iTunes, and somebody from all around the world can hear it. My current band, Six Day Ride, it's on iTunes. I'm getting sales from America. I don't have any distribution in America, but because we own the rights for the world, I can assign it to the iTunes site for the world. And so, last week we had a little bit of airplane radio too. We sold 6 copies in America. Not a lot, it's not going to pay for lunch, but it's 6 copies that I know that I can trace, and it's 6 copies that I would never have gotten normally.
And the MySpace thing as well, I mean, majors are scooping up MySpace artists left and right because they don't want that to get started, because they Snowcap has put something where you can put your own record store on your site, and people are buying records on MySpace from the independent artists. They don't want to even let that get started. They don't want to even get wind of that, so they're like scooping up all these MySpace artists. So it's a lot easier and a lot more open right now.
Okay, we've got time for one more quick question. Who was first in the queue?
This guy was first.
Hi, it is great to hear from your experience, and I personally believe that in terms of in arts and music and sound, the principal thing is the idea, whatever form it comes from. But talking about a technical point, in my journey I found a particular challenge in mixing in the digital domain. That is probably because there is no such headroom as in the when you're familiar with the concept of hot mixing, using and pushing the electronics, you get a punchy sound, and I have difficulty getting that in the digital domain, say in Logic or Pro Tools. And a way to work around that for me has been doing a mastering with a proper sub 10 gear to do.
This is really sort of an analog versus digital question.
To me, I don't know if it's really the headroom, but what is your take or your thoughts on this? How to get that punchy sound? I don't know. I had difficulty trying to get that sound until I got more experience on time.
You mean hitting hard enough?
Yeah,
how do you use the mastering?
A Massenburg equalizer and any kind of high-end compressor that I get my hands on.
Okay.
With a compressor, maybe 2 compressors and a finalizer, then I can get a good sound. But
if you want it punchy,
but the VU meters are like slamming. That's what I want. But we talk more and more.
Let Marshall talk.
If you want it punchy, get a liquid mix, Waves Ultra Maximizer. You get it punchy in 10 minutes. I can master it in 10 minutes and have it punchy.
Yeah, I haven't used that plugin. Okay,
The man's standing right in front of you.
Waves is software. It's got presets. Presets would be 24-bit CD master. full liquid mix, or any number of sentences. But
I'll check it out.
You could check that out. You could do it in, you could do 10-minute master and have it punchy as hell.
Thank you. My name is C.R. Washington.
Okay, one final question over there. Thank you.
How's your arm? You were holding it up there for a while. Sore?
It's pretty sore. Okay, hi guys. This is really quite a sort of a technical question in terms of production versus songwriting. As a producer, I've worked on a number of projects, collaborated with a lot of American artists, and I find that with collaborating, what is the distinction, where do you draw the line between actually producing and then sharing the songwriting? Because in some instances you have to write different parts, you have to write riffs, you have to sometimes change the ending of a song to make it work, or you know you have to edit things. And what line do you draw at becoming a co-songwriter?
That's asked every day for the last 50 or so, 200 years, you know. That depends on who you're working with, whether they're flexible or not. If somebody brings a song to the studio, I always say they wrote it, no matter what I add to the project. You know, but sometimes if they don't have the song ready, you know, they have like just a bass line, which is very rare for me because, like I said, if the demo's not there, then, you know, but I would think if they bring nothing to the studio except maybe a bass line and some drums, maybe you can work something out. But it's always depending on the artist.
It has to be a case-by-case basis.
Yeah.
I think that,
you can,
yeah, I think that, you know, everyone gets a little bit precious about their song, but sometimes it is often, you know, a producer's arrangement that actually makes that song quite a bit more substantial than it actually was. Sometimes it's a simple thing of, you know, changing the key and suddenly it's a great thing. But I think there's two sides to look at it. There's co-songwriting, i.e. the credit is shared by the two people, or there's the originator of the song is still the credited songwriter, but the producer, artist, record label, gets a slice of that song on a business level. They're two different things, and I think it's wholly appropriate that if that person's contribution has enabled that record to move to a different level because of that, then I think it's only fair that person should participate in that. And I think it's very important in this current climate, because record sales are probably the smallest part of the income in the short term. So I think it's wholly unfair that maybe a producer would work on a track with a given artist and the only generated revenue would be some airplay and no sales. Then that's not fair. So that's not fair from the other side. So I think every single example has to be taken on its own merits, but you must agree those terms before you leave that studio, because as they say, where there's a hit, there's
a key.
And if you don't
agree
that,
room,
the thing is, if you present a song to a producer and the producer says, that's fantastic, I'm going to change this and this and this, and I want half, and you go, great, then sign a piece of paper and agree to that. If you say, I want 75, 25, or whatever the deal is you agree on, write it down, sign it, and then forget about it, and then you're done and doing, and concentrate on making a record. What you can't have is a situation where 3 weeks down the line, the guy goes, you know what, I think I deserve 75% because I think it's better. And if it's on the radio, then you're never going to get it back. Agree right from the beginning what that is, whatever you feel happy with. I mean, there's always, it's business. You know, it is a business, and artists need to be less pedantic about it now and go, this is my asset, but I need you, and I need this to make it happen, and I'm prepared to give you X, Y, Z, and you can't.
I really never get into, like, percentages. I just say if two people write it, it's 50-50.
Exactly. It's the fairest way, actually. In truth, that is the fairest
way. I'm not going to argue about
yeah.
it.
Three people in the room, yeah.
Even if this guy farted on the record, he, you know, yeah. he gets 33%.
No, I agree. That's the one that causes the least argument. The number of people in the room contributing to make it work.
I think that's about all that we've got time for. Nice to finish on the fart, okay? I'd like to thank all three producers, particularly Marshall in the middle, who's actually been up mixing all night, so I'm glad he turned up at all. I'm very grateful for that, so show your appreciation.
You have been listening to Sam Downey's Techcasts in association with DailyTechTalk.com, reporting from the Sounds Expo 2007, which took place at Olympia 2 in London. Further information on Sounds Expo, go online at www.sounds-expo.com. www.technologymachine.co.uk. And to get all the latest technology news and reviews, go online at www.dailytechtalk.com. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.